Coming up on the program, why the Chinese economy is so hard for American companies today and has been hard for the Chinese people for decades. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizda. Monday, the 1st of August. Today, good as always to have you with us, everybody. You can't quite say that China is the biggest untapped market in the world anymore. There has been plenty of tapping in the past 40 or so years, but it is still a really attractive business proposition, which explains why so many American companies have tried and are still trying to get a toehold there. Catch is that sometimes it works and sometimes it don't. Today's entry in the don't category is Uber. The company has sold its Chinese operations to its local rival, Didi Chuxing is that company's name, in return for a slice of its operations. So Uber comes out ahead. But this deal is an object lesson in how hard it is for American companies to thrive in that Chinese market. Marketplace's Annie Baxter gets us going.
Uber has been trying to get a foothold in China since 2013. It's been subsidizing drivers and riders to try to scale up its business there and knock out competitors. That was costing it gobs of money.
I never thought Uber was going to work in China.
Rob Atkinson is president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. He says foreign internet firms have had a hard time operating in China because the government favors homegrown competitors.
Every single internet company in the U.S. has a clone in China that's copied their technology and dominated the market, whether it's in search or social network or shopping with Alibaba.
Even Apple, which is a popular brand in China, recently ran into trouble. A small Chinese startup won an injunction against it in an intellectual property dispute. Atkinson says this is a departure from the China of the 80s and 90s, which welcomed foreign direct investment, like from U.S. automakers.
It began to change about a decade ago, really began to change with Xi Jinping to be much more about indigenous innovation. In other words, Chinese companies.
Some of the preference for Chinese companies has to do with data security, according to Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group. Bremmer says the Chinese government doesn't like American companies like Uber holding the reins on data about Chinese consumers.
I think the Chinese government really feels like for the most, what will soon be the most important consumer market in the world, that they would much rather control the data. They would want to control the filters.
The Uber China brand will stick around under Didi, but all the consumer data will now be owned by the Chinese company. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Chances are that one party or the other's position on the Federal Reserve isn't going to swing a whole lot of votes in this election. That said, the GOP and the Democrats do differ on the Fed. The Republican Party, among other things, calls for more transparency in monetary policy. The Democrats, also among other things, insist that the Fed has to be more diverse and that actual practicing bankers shouldn't be doubling as central bankers. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more on the Dems and the Fed.
Getting more diversity at the Federal Reserve? Not too controversial. Janet Yellen even agrees. But the second issue is a little more thorny. What role should private banks play on the 12 regional Fed boards?
They get representatives on those boards of directors. And we think that that's an egregious example of regulatory capture.
Adi Barkin is campaign director of Fed Up, a left-leaning group that's pushed for changes at the Fed. Andrew Levin is professor of economics at Dartmouth College.
You can't imagine, for example, that, you know, cable networks would get some special role in choosing the people on the FCC.
The Fed has already undergone some major reforms to limit influence, for example, in choosing regional Fed presidents.
The bankers themselves are not involved in the choice of that person.
Stephen Cicchetti is professor of economics at Brandeis International Business School.
And that is the person who participates in the monetary policy discussions.
That reform came out of Dodd-Frank. Lastly, he says regional Fed banks don't actually do any regulation of private banks.
They don't even get to see the stuff.
Chair Yellen herself has said that if the Fed were redesigned from scratch, it'd probably look pretty different now than it did at its creation 103 years ago, but it works pretty well. Cicchetti agrees.
I don't see that anyone's been able to show that there's any harm or that there's been pressure that's been applied by the banks through their directors to the policy of the Federal Reserve.
Changing the structure of the Fed would require an act of Congress. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Airlines have been doing all right lately. Summertime has brought a record number of passengers and with it record profits. So airlines are doing stock buybacks and distributing dividends to investors, yet analysts are not happy. Without trying to get too weedy here, there is a little thing with a clunky name. It's called unit revenue, which has not been quite so good. Marketplace's Ashley Montite explains.
Carriers don't get all their revenue from fares. They get plenty from things like baggage and cancellation fees. So to know how well they're doing from passengers, you need to look at something called passenger revenue per available seat mile, another name for unit revenue.
That gives you the most accurate look at how the airlines are now doing. And they're not doing as well as they were doing even 3 months ago.
Joe Brancatelli runs JoeSentMe.com, a website for business travelers. Cheaper fuel encouraged airlines to add flights, but he says they haven't attracted enough travelers.
And what the airlines are beginning to tell us is that going forward, they will be cutting back again because they have too many empty seats.
Which should bring unit revenue up again. Robert Mann is an airline industry analyst.
In the kind of economics 101 sense, if we saw a balance between the supply of airline seats and the demand for airline seats, we would see stable pricing.
But he says it's tough to get it just right. Airlines don't have a crystal ball. Fuel prices fluctuate. They have to lock down costs months in advance. Then geopolitics can upend everything. And then cost-cutting rivals can come on the scene.
Norwegian Air, WOW Air, which is an Icelandic-based carrier, both of whom are offering extremely low fares on the North Atlantic, cannibalizing some traditional fare demand and growing very fast.
He says this won't affect U.S. airlines immediately, but it is yet another threat on the horizon. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Mostly calm on Wall Street today, not quite a straight line from open to close, but close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Tracy Samuelson did a story not too long ago about how refugee resettlement happens in this country, how any given refugee winds up in, say, Phoenix or Peoria or maybe Minneapolis. Out of the reporting for that story, Tracy has been following a group of Syrian refugees assigned to a nonprofit in New Haven, Connecticut, a nonprofit that is trying something a little bit different, getting the community involved. Here's Tracy.
In the middle of a big, empty parking lot in New Haven, Connecticut, half a dozen people stand outside their parked cars. They've been here for maybe 5 hours, waiting for Syrian refugees who are very delayed.
No, is that my drink right?
Don Quinn holds a big sign with an Arabic welcome.
Yeah, that's right.
Barbara Billings stands nearby holding a Syrian flag and stuffed animals.
This is when I start crying. It's very emotional.
For months, they've been preparing for the arrival of two Syrian families, finding apartments for them, collecting donations to furnish them, researching schools for the kids, English language classes, fundraising to help support the families for the first 6 months they're here.
This is a great unknown, and it's also a huge responsibility.
Terry Schmidt is a member of one of the groups, about 50 people from three different congregations, two Christian, one Jewish, who came together after seeing that photo of the Syrian toddler who drowned off the coast of Turkey. They decided they needed to do something. But he knows the road ahead isn't going to be easy.
Our family has got three kids with a fourth one on the way. I'm scared. That intimidates me right off the bat. They don't speak our language. We have to help them navigate our culture because the object is success.
Terry's group is working with a New Haven nonprofit called IRIS, Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services. The group is taking over much of the work that the nonprofit staff would normally do. Last year, IRIS resettled 240 refugees. They're hoping to almost double that this year, and that the extra 200 refugees will be taken on by community groups like this one.
What does this mean?
Earlier in the day, Chris George, the director of IRIS, spoke to about 10 community groups in a day-long training.
It means that other refugee resettlement agencies might replicate this model. Other states might get interested.
He thinks the U.S. could increase the number of refugees it accepts each year by working with more community groups. Canada already does something similar. It's resettled nearly 30,000 Syrian refugees since November. About a third were privately sponsored. In the same time period, the U.S. resettled about 6,500 Syrians. Of course, not everyone wants to increase these numbers. Republican candidate Donald Trump opposes accepting refugees from Syria. More than 30 governors have also said they oppose settling Syrian refugees in their states because of security concerns. I think they're here. A big white van pulls into the parking lot, and then another a few minutes later. And the group, which had been loud and laughing and giddy with excitement a few minutes ago, they quiet down.
So the two men come out first. Woman, two kids, baby girl in her arms.
Welcome. I asked Terry about the commitment he's making, all the work that lies ahead. And what happens if the group burns out? After all, this isn't their job.
If there were going to be burnout would have happened 5 months ago, but not now. I'm not worried about it now. The energy level's unbelievable. It's off the wall. People are so excited.
One of the Syrian men, Ali, a father of three with one more on the way, lights a cigarette and he rubs his eyes. His wife, Fatima, gets in the car while Don tries to get the kids into car seats. Don holds out a yogurt and asks, snack? They load a surprising amount of luggage into the cars and say a quick goodbye to the other group.
Good luck with your babies. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. All those babies.
That's how the community groups refer to these arrivals. Our family, our babies. Like they're adopting them. Like they're already family. But really, they're supposed to help these refugees exist without them, to become self-sufficient. Ideally, in the next 6 months. Ali looks at Terry.
Thank you.
Thank you, he says, as if to say goodbye.
You will be seeing me.
You will be see?
I will see you up in West Hartford.
Yeah, thank you.
They pile into the cars and head off to show the family their new home. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Coming up!
I would say I tried a lot to hide what happened to my family.
Family history and the changing Chinese economy. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 27 points today, about a 10%, 18,404. The NASDAQ boosted 22 points. That is up 0.4%, 5184. The S&P 500 down 2, a 10%, 2170. A glut is defined as an excessively abundant supply of something. That something is oil again, down below $40 a barrel at one point today. Chevron thus slipped 3.3%. ExxonMobil shed 3.4%. BP off 2% today. Tesla Motors reached a deal to buy the solar panel company SolarCity for $2.6 billion. We kind of knew it was coming, not a surprise. Investors, however, threw some shade. Tesla sputtered 2%. SolarCity, shade, get it? SolarCity burned 7.4%. Bonds down. Yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.51%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Insurance is by its very nature, and no matter how hard insurance companies crunch the numbers, it is a risky business. Car insurers collected more than $200 billion in premiums last year, but the business model has a looming blind spot: cars that don't need drivers. So insurance companies are doing what they can to mitigate the risk to their profits. Leslie Sism is an editor at the Wall Street Journal. She wrote about this not too long ago. Leslie, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
The numbers here are staggering, potentially, for the auto insurance industry. As much as an 80% drop in accidents as cars begin to drive themselves?
That is the potential. Whether that actually comes about or when it comes about are very big questions.
Mm-hmm. What is not really a question, though, is that when these accidents do stop happening, insurance companies are going to have to look at things and sort of reevaluate, right?
That's right, because car insurance right now largely exists to pay out for wrecks. So if driverless cars live up to their potential and there are many fewer wrecks, then a lot of the reason for being is gone for the car insurance companies.
Who exactly would be being insured here? Is it the companies creating the software code that the driverless cars would use? Is it the person who owns the driverless car? We don't know, do we?
A lot of people assume that if accident frequency drops tremendously, that the car insurers would still be needed to pay for some damage to the cars. The issue arises, what if these driverless cars malfunction? Or what if the software is hacked?
Oh,
the
yeah.
thought is that you'd still need some kind of insurance. Would it be paid by the driver, or would the car companies and the other gear makers have to take on more product liability insurance to cover those events?
Yeah, well, about that, State Farm is doing something really interesting.
Yes, State Farm is the nation's biggest car insurer with about an 18% market share. State Farm is a founding partner and sits in a leadership circle at the University of Michigan's Mobility Transformation Center, which runs one of the nation's leading test sites for driverless car gear. So State Farm is right there in this inner circle getting a firsthand look at the technology as it's being developed. That's a very enviable position because it can figure out, if it has to shift what it's insuring, it's got an early look at how this shift is going to occur.
This is an imperfect metaphor, but is it sleeping with the enemy or is it good business?
State Farm doesn't feel it has any other choice.
Yeah.
And State Farm is committed to safety. As I said, it has this long history of supporting better and safer cars. So it feels like it will evolve. It has faith that it'll figure out new products and services that it could sell.
And also,
maybe it one day sells cyber risk insurance, for instance.
Right. It's entirely possible, just given, and we've all seen this in the past 10 years in technology, that it's entirely possible that the speed of the technology outstrips, forget insurance companies, but the government and regulators and frankly, society's ability to deal with it, right? Yeah?
Perhaps, but car insurance is an industry that's regulated by 50 different state insurance departments.
Oh, yeah.
So the regulators can, so to speak, put the brakes on some of this, some of this research.
Leslie Sism, she is an editor at the Wall Street Journal, writing recently about insurance companies and self-driving cars. Leslie, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
A couple of years ago, our China correspondent Rob Schmitz did a series called The Street of Eternal Happiness, stories of the people who live on that street in Shanghai. Today, in a city that is changing so fast, a story that hits remarkably close to home, his home. Here's Rob.
I moved to an apartment complex in 2010. It's called The Summit. It's made up of 8 high-rises surrounding a green courtyard where my children play. It was built a decade ago along the Street of Eternal Happiness. Once, I asked a neighbor what used to be on this land. Just a bunch of old rundown hovels, he said with a swipe of his hand. Later, I learned hundreds of families lived here, sleeping where my family now sleeps. What happened to them? Seniors in the old alleyway homes across the street all pointed me to a woman named Xi.
Yeah.
Yeah. The day I met Xi Guojian, she had just stepped off a train from Beijing, where she was released from prison that very morning. For 20 years, the 61-year-old has petitioned China's government to investigate the death of her husband. He died when developers came to demolish his home to make way for the high-rise where I live. Ever since, his widow's routine is predictable. She pleads for justice outside Zhongnanhai, the headquarters of China's Communist Party along Tiananmen Square in Beijing. She's tackled by police, and she goes to prison.
One time I spent 14 days there.
One time, 38 days, and this time, 6 days. Whenever they let me out, I go straight back to Zhengnanhai.
Her life is on repeat. Before my complex was built, she and her husband, Zhu Jianzhong, had an apartment on the second floor of a house where they lived with their son. In 1992, the local government sold their neighborhood to a developer owned by Li Kai-shing, the richest man in Asia. The developer gave residents apartments in a faraway suburb in return for leaving their homes. She and her husband refused.
One day at around 8 in the morning, I was returning from the market when six of the developer's thugs tackled me outside my home and pushed me into a car.
Several others, as she climbed a ladder to her balcony. She says she screamed for her husband, but it was too late. There was a scuffle inside, and then black smoke poured out of the balcony window before the house went up in flames. She's husband burned to death. The developer's men escaped. The developer said she's husband set himself on fire.
My theory is that they beat him up badly. In China, if you injure someone in a situation like this, you have to pay more in compensation than if he died. I think they burned him to death to avoid the cost.
10 years later, the man in charge of the demolition crew that confronted Xi's husband was sentenced to death by a Shanghai court for burning an elderly couple to death across the street during the demolition of that neighborhood. Xi and Zhu's son, Wei Qi, was just 10 years old when his father died. That day, police escorted the boy from school to a government-owned motel where he was detained with his mother for the next year and a half.
When he learned his father died, he kept hitting the wall until his hand started bleeding. He stopped talking.
That was 20 years ago. I was almost scared to ask what had happened to him. He's finishing his PhD at Kung Nao, she said in Chinese. Cornell. Cornell University. Wei Qi Zhu is 29 years old, and he works here inside Hong Kong's second tallest skyscraper. When he's not finishing his doctoral thesis in finance, he trades derivatives for one of the world's largest banks. What he's accomplished in the 19 years since his father's death is just as impressive as his country's incredible development during that same period. Wei Qi thanks his father for his success.
First of all, he is a really, really good father. I think he is kind of like the father in a growing pain.
If you didn't catch that, he said growing pains.
As long as we got each other, we got the world spinning right in our hands, baby.
The show was popular in China in the 1990s. He and his father watched it religiously. Life in his neighborhood was carefree, he says. It was like living in a village inside the largest city in China. After his father died, Wei Qi turned inward. He spent his time studying and trying to blend in.
I would say I tried a lot to hide what happened to my family.
His mother did the opposite. During his teenage years, she was constantly getting arrested in Beijing, leaving him in their tiny apartment alone. Wei Qi says this never bothered him. He's always believed her quest for justice is right.
If I were against it, I think she were in a much, much like tougher situation, because it would be like no one in this entire world understand her.
Wei Qi has only returned to his old neighborhood once. It's now full of expats and European restaurants, reminiscent of a time before the Chinese united under communism to expel Shanghai's foreign occupiers, a time when this neighborhood was run by the French.
It's kind of sad. There are so many foreigners actually right now live there.
I'm one of those foreigners. I tuck my children into bed above the spot Wei Qi's father used to tuck him in at night. I watch my children play where his father used to watch him play. Wei Qi says his father's death taught him that however bad things seem, things could always be worse. Since then, he's always stayed calm under pressure, a trait that's helped him in the high-stakes world of derivatives trading. One night, when he was in middle school, the police came to his door. He was home alone. His mother had been gone to Beijing for weeks to petition the government again. He had just cooked himself some noodles.
Firstly, they tried to knock a door, and I just asked, like, who are you? And they said the policeman, and I told them, like, my mother was not there. They said, yes, she was not there because she was detained, and I need a signature, and I just refused to open the door.
The police smashed through the door, ripping it off its hinges. They handled a startled Wei Qi a document stating his mother was in prison in Beijing. He refused to sign it. The officers stormed off, leaving the boy inside an apartment without a door. At 14 years old, Weichi had lost his father, his home, and now his mother would be away for a while, too. Hardly anything scared him anymore. He stepped over the splintered mess and walked down to the street where he found a handyman. A new door was in place before he tucked himself into bed that evening. On the Street of Eternal Happiness, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, a pause perhaps before you head out to eat tonight. The Center for Science and the Public Interest is out with its annual Extreme Eating Awards, a way to shine the spotlight, shall we say, on some chain restaurants and how they might not be the best thing for your waistline. We've got a link on our website to the whole list. Here's my favorite. It's from Uno's Pizzeria, the Whole Hog Burger, it's called. It's got hamburger, sausage, bacon, prosciutto, pepperoni, and four kinds of cheese. It comes with fries and onion rings and 2,850 calories. That's like a whole day's plus allotment. Also, 6 days worth of sodium, almost 10,000 milligrams. So, you know, eat up. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 27 points today, about a 10%, 18,404 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ gained 22, that is 0.4%, 5184. The S&P 500 down 2, 10%, 2170. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Everybody all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.